Welcome to the Valley Voices podcast. I'm Summer Keppel. The Valley Voices Story Slam series invites storytellers from across the Valley to come together to share their funny, heartwarming, and sometimes outrageous stories in front of a crowd of supportive New Englanders. Three winners are chosen from each slam and will continue on to compete at the Best of Valley Voices coming up in October. We kicked off season 4 of Valley Voices at the Alvastone in Montague, Massachusetts. The theme of the night was neighbors. 10 storytellers gave us their best neighbor stories, and in this episode, we'll be hearing the top 3 stories chosen by the audience that night and meeting the storytellers behind them. With me now to tell us about her story is Eve Brown-Waite. Welcome, Eve.
Well, hi. Thanks for having me.
So, typically I would ask if this is your first experience with this kind of storytelling thing, but I know that you have a book, First Comes Love, Then Comes the Malaria, How a Peace Corps Poster Boy Won My Heart and a Third World Adventure Changed My Life. So it's clear you're keen on storytelling. When you were in the midst of this memoir-worthy life, did you keep a journal or record all these events and travels ever?
I didn't exactly keep a journal, but I wrote a lot of letters, tons and tons of letters. And I guess the letters were pretty funny because most people kept them. So then at the end of it, when I decided to write a book, I asked people if they had copies of the letters, and they did. And so I used the letters kind of as a bit as a journal. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's an interesting way to write a book. So why do you think it's important to share stories?
I think stories is how we make sense of the world as human beings. We like a narrative. We like to see how things connect. We like to connect them even if they don't connect. And I think storytelling helps us do that. Oh, thank you so much. Yes. Thank you. Ooh, hi. I'm Eve Brown-Waite, and I would yell if I could, so please listen. It took an enormous amount of vodka and sheep fat to convince the neighbors that we were not spies. But why else would an American family choose to move into an ugly apartment in a Soviet-style apartment complex in Uzbekistan immediately after the collapse of the Soviet Union? You couldn't come up with a better way to get up close and personal with lots of neighbors. We would all be out there in the communal courtyard taking turns as our children used the only swing that worked and literally hanging out our laundry together. We'd be bumping into each other in the stairwells, in the hallways, every time the lights went out. We'd all line up together with our buckets at the only spigot in the neighborhood every time they turned off the water in our apartments. But we were not spies. My husband was the associate director of Peace Corps in Uzbekistan. And so we had packed up our 2-year-old daughter and our house cat, and we moved to the capital city of Tashkent. John and I were real Peace Corps types. And I thought that we'd be holding hands with our new friends and singing kumbaya just as soon as we unpacked. But that is not what happened. Nobody in Tashkent seemed to want to be our friends. That didn't mean that they didn't talk to us specifically to give us instructions. That kind of made sense. You see, Uzbekistan has a very long history. And Uzbeks have their own language, culture, and customs. But they had essentially been invaded by the Russians, who brought their language, culture, and customs, and everybody had to live together during the Soviet Union, which had its own set of rules. So as foreigners, we were completely lost. Luckily, our apartment was on the ground floor, and we had a big window that opened up to the communal courtyard, and people walked back and forth all day and all night, and they never hesitated to stop at our window and give us advice. And I had people come and tell me where I should go shopping and what I should buy and what price I could expect to pay for it. They told me when certain fruits and produce were in season and when they were about to go out of season, so I'd better hurry up, buy up everything, and go back home and conservats. Now, I didn't know how to conservats, but the neighbors were willing to tell me Conservance means canning. And the neighbors stood outside my window, and they taught me how to do that. I had an old woman come one day and ask if she could go through my garbage because she wanted to make sure that I wasn't throwing out any bread. Throwing out bread is prohibited in Uzbek culture. So she told me that I could leave the bread out to feed to the birds, or I could feed it to the very skinny donkey that came clomping through the courtyard every morning with the man who bought the bottles. Potelki pokupayem! He would yell up at all the windows, and the neighbors would come down with their arms loaded with empty vodka bottles. See, drinking vodka, that's a Russian custom. And the neighbors came by the window to ask for things, too. A glass of water on a hot afternoon? Sure. A needle and thread in the middle of the night? Comrade, can you spare a schlong? I didn't know what I was being asked for, but apparently the people on the fourth floor were out of water, and the people on the third floor were looking for a hose. But the best request of all came from a brave 10-year-old who lived in the building next door, and she asked if she could come over and speak English with us. And she did, and she soon became a close friend of ours, as did her parents, who then introduced us to their friends, who introduced us to their friends, and so on. And friends everywhere love to share food and drink. In Uzbekistan, the drink is vodka, and the food is sheep fat. And our new friends were very, very generous. And 2 years later, when our time in Uzbekistan was over, my husband and I threw a party in the courtyard, and we served vodka and sheep fat, and all of our neighbors came. And we toasted each other, we said goodbye, and we all cried. Because we hadn't been spies, but we had found our way into the hearts of our neighbors. And they had definitely found their way into ours. Thank you.
All right, Eve, that was your performance. So now we're going to talk a little bit more specifically about the story that you told. You described you and your husband as real Peace Corps types, but once you realized the actuality of your surroundings in Uzbekistan, did you ever feel like you might have made a mistake?
We had spent 3 years in Uganda, so coming to Uzbekistan was like, oh my God, it was like paradise. I can't explain it. We had a phone in our apartment, and it worked sometimes. And when you turned on the taps, water came out. The water was orange, and it smelled like rust, but it came out. And, you know, we had been living for 3 years in very rural Uganda, where we had none of those things. So, oh gosh, no, to me, Uzbekistan was a paradise.
So have you kept up with or talked to or seen the 10-year-old girl in the family you became close with since your time in Uzbekistan?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I could write another book about that. That 10-year-old girl, her name is Anya. Our family and her family became very, very, very close friends, such that when we left Uzbekistan, after 2.5 years, we took Anya with us. We got her a passport and a ticket, and we said, surprise, you're coming to America for Christmas. We left Uzbekistan right before Christmas. So that was her Christmas present. And in the subsequent years, Anya came back and forth to visit us. Her parents came back and forth. Her parents ultimately won the green card lottery, which means that they were eligible to become citizens. Mm-hmm. We helped them move to Greenfield. They hated it. I mean, they stayed for 1.5 years, but the transition was too hard for them. But Anya stayed. She went to Brown University.
Wow.
She went to Wharton. And now she lives out. She's a citizen. She lives out in San Francisco, where she works for Google, and she's married to a French guy. I performed their wedding, and now they have a 1-year-old daughter who calls us Grammy and Papa.
Oh my God, so, that's an amazing transition.
She's my Uzbek daughter. We're her American family.
Now with us is another winner, Kevin Gallagher. So typically I would ask if this is your first time doing something like this, but I know that you actually have had Valley Voices experiences. So how would you say your two experiences compare?
Oh, that's a great question. Some of the ways they're very similar is really awesome audiences that are really receptive. I would also say it was really fun to have another opportunity to tell a story that I like very much. It's less for me about winning anything or being picked for anything. For me, sort of the exchange as a storyteller that you get with an audience, even if it's only for 5 or 6 minutes, is really sort of like kind of magical.
Yeah, so that's actually a good segue into what I was going to ask you next. So why do you think it's so important to share stories?
Sort of in my family growing up, storytelling was always important. But I do think that the role that stories play culturally is how we share our life experiences and connect with other people. I'm a psychotherapist, and so part of my job, I think, is really listening to people's stories.
So at the end of the night, each storyteller is asked to step back on stage and say 3 words to describe their story just to remind the audience. So how would you use 3 words to describe yourself or what you represent?
Work in progress.
Well, if 50 Shades of Grey is a book about adventures and sex, then my book would be called 50 Shades of Green, because I am Irish and I'm pretty green when it comes to most things, especially sex. So the story I want to tell you tonight is about my first orgy, because that was a very different shade of sex for me. But I can tell you right now, you don't have to get too excited, because my first orgy was my last orgy. Because if I am anything, I am Irish. We are an uptight and rigid crowd. There's not a loose Latin lover in the mix. So this was years after graduation. A bunch of us friends were all back in Boston for a weekend. It was Saturday night. Everyone's trying to figure out how to get their dance on for the evening. There's a couple of gay people in our group, and then mostly straight, you know, like the rest of the world. You know, the women and the gays are really interested in going to gay bars because the music's better and the drinks are better. But, you know, straight guys just have a hard time, you know, at gay bars because they're always sure that they're going to get hit on. And so we decided to go to a couple of gay bars first and then end up at a straight club at the end of the night. So this was the 90s, and so most gay bars look like, you know, hunky guys in their underwear dancing on the bars or in cages up on the ceiling. It was probably the same here in Montague, you know, back in the 90s. That was everywhere, you know, back then. But we ended the night at this triplex in Boston, 3 floors of sweaty, straight people dancing to throbbing house music. And at the end of the night, my old college roommate, Curtis, came up to me and he said, so I've been talking to some people and they're having an after party. You know, should we go? Sure. Now, the reason I said yes is for three reasons. One, it meets my criteria that I'm not drunk, I'm not tired, and I'm still having a good time. So we walked over to the Back Bay, and beautiful apartment, actually. And, you know, it's always a little iffy at an after party because it could be like 8 people stoned on the couch playing video games. So we walk in, and it's about 20 people there, and there's music, and there's food, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is going to be like a great party. About a half hour in, some of the guys started taking off their shirts. Now, this is not unusual, you know, for straight people, I imagine. I would never take off my shirt anywhere because I'm Irish. But then after a while, the women started taking off their shirts. And I thought, well, now that is more unusual. You know, but, you know, I don't know what I know. And at one point, I went to the bathroom. And when I came out, I noticed that there were a number of pairs of people sort of making out. Now, this is not unusual in high school, but when you're in your 30s, you don't go to someone's house to make out. You just go home. And then these little make-out pairs started moving toward each other, and they formed make-out clusters, and then clothes started coming off. Well, I panicked, and I looked around for Curtis, and he's lost in some sort of cluster grope of some sort. And so I go in the kitchen, I down a half a beer, I go out, this guy comes up to me, actually a really cute guy, and he's like, you gonna join in? And I'm like, oh, totally. Like, can't wait. I'm just waiting for the bathroom. And I'm like, but I'll be right there. And so I go into the bathroom, and I'm pacing around. I'm like, oh, my God, I can't do this. I don't have breath mints. I need floss. I don't know what underwear I wore tonight. And I got myself so anxious that I slipped out of the bathroom, slipped out of the apartment, and was walking down the street going nowhere. And I ran into an old college friend, and we chatted, and she was a neighbor. She lived a couple of houses away. And I told her the situation. She said, "Do you want to just crash at my place?" And I said, "Sure." So in the morning, Curtis called me. You know, I was so worried about you. And I'm thinking, like 9 hours later, so worried. Why did you leave? And I said, "Well, you know, the orgy thing. I just really wasn't into the whole orgy thing." And he said, "Well, you didn't have to leave. You could have, like, stayed and watched." Yeah, Curtis, that's been the dream of my life. I want to be the guy at an orgy, sitting in a chair with my clothes on, drinking a beer, watching naked people have sex. Like, I don't already have low self-esteem. So I say this was my first orgy, but I don't know if an orgy depends on whether you participate or not. So, thanks.
Okay, so that was Kevin's performance. Now we're going to get a little bit more specific with the questions. So originally, where did you foresee this night going? Was Curtis the type of friend where you already knew that any night with him was going to be unusual, or was this completely out of the blue for you?
No, if I had seen an orgy in sight, I would have gone back to campus. In terms of Curtis, I would never think of Curtis. He's very protective of me as my roommate from college, even in adulthood, that he would not have kind of dragged me to something knowing full well what it was without telling me, because he would know I'd be like a nervous wreck. So I think he was as surprised as well. So I don't say it's in character for him to kind of do these things or get me into these kinds of situations, but I can tell you that I have numerous stories about things that Curtis and I have gotten ourselves into. So I think it might be sort of the combination of when we're together.
Yeah, so it sounds like you definitely have a lot of stories to share. Would you say that you've always lived this kind of life where interesting or storytelling-worthy things are always happening to you?
You know, actually, I think, surprisingly, everyone lives a life where there is an immense amount of storytelling that comes out of it. I think it's really about how you look at your life. Mm-hmm. So I tend to notice sort of the bizarreness or the foolishness or the kind of the stressfulness of situations, and those sometimes turn into some really great stories. But I don't think I have a storytelling life. I think everyone has a storytelling life, but you'd have to look at your life differently to realize how many great stories you have.
Okay, so now we're just going to ask a couple parting questions. Do you have any advice or words of wisdom for the next group of storytellers?
My biggest piece of advice, which someone very wise gave me when I said, "What if I just forget everything when I get to the microphone?" And she said, "Kevin, you can't forget everything. You lived it. So you can remember your own life, I'm pretty sure. And you might not get the order right. You might leave something out, but the audience won't know that. They didn't know your life."
All right, Kevin, thank you so much for speaking with us, and we're going to see you again this fall.
Well, it was a pleasure to talk with you, and I really appreciate everything that the Valley Voices does to promote storytelling and get people to come together.
All right, now we're going to be talking to one more winner, Shirley Williams. Welcome, Shirley.
Hello, Summer.
So before we listen to your story, we're going to talk a little bit about your experience. So was this your first time ever doing something like this?
This was absolutely my first encounter with doing this sort of thing.
How do you think it went?
Well, I survived, and during the performance, the audience did laugh. When I sat down, they applauded, so I suppose it was successful all around.
Now, would you say it's important to share stories?
Oh, definitely. I think that stories are a way to pass on the culture to the next generation, the history. It was the first way to pass on knowledge, and it's still a good way to entertain as well as passing on that knowledge.
What are three words that you use to describe yourself or what you represent?
Well, if you will allow me to use one hyphenated word as my three, I would say I'm just an old-fashioned yarn spinner. I tell the stories the way they've been told forever. My mother's choice of a murder weapon was a cast iron skillet. It wasn't planned. My family had been very edgy and emotional since my father's death about a month before. Taking care of Daddy during his illness had made us somewhat isolated, and we had not yet met our new neighbors across the alley. One night, we were in the kitchen, Mother just beginning supper preparations, my brother and I doing our homework. Just as Mother stood up, after reaching in a lower cupboard to get her huge cast iron skillet, she saw a strange old man standing in the doorway. Her scream sent my brother and me scurrying under the table where we watched and listened to what happened. "Who are you? And what are you doing in my kitchen?" she screamed, raising that skillet like a tennis racket ready to make a killer serve. The man just stood there, but then, decibel for decibel, he answered her, "Ain't this Leonie's house?" Mother's fear and rage apparently made her unable to understand, for she just took a step forward, waved that skillet, and repeated, "Who are you? And what are you doing in my house?" The man seemed dumbfounded, and he could only say again, "Ain't this Leonie's house?" From under the table, my brother and I listened to this insane exchange becoming more emotional and louder with each repetition. After several of these back and forths, Mother had made her way across the kitchen and was within striking distance of the man. And we could tell from the look in her eyes that she had every intention of killing him if need be. Just as she pulled that skillet back to make what could be a fatal blow to his head, a woman rushed into the kitchen, gasping, "Papa, Papa, you're in the wrong house." He turned and looked at her as relief flooded down him. Mother looked at this second intruder very suspiciously and held on to her skillet because she had set a course of action and she wasn't going to be easily deterred. I'm Mrs. G, your new neighbor, and this is my father visiting from Arkansas. I sent him to the alley to the garbage can, but he got turned around. I saw him crossing your yard, and I raced after him, but I was too late. Oh, I am so sorry. We could see Mother contemplating whether she wanted to believe this strange woman's story or to include her in the lethal skillet attack. After all, if you kill one, the second one is easy. We just quit breathing because nobody knew what was going to happen next. But after what seemed an eternity, very slowly, mother's arm and the skillet came to rest by her side. Oh, let me tell you, it took a long, long time for us to calm down after the G's went home. But eventually, mother went back to supper and my brother and me to our schoolwork. I had a form to fill out for my teacher. One of the questions was, parents' occupation, place of employment. Oh, how glad I was. I didn't have to put down murderer, state prison.
All right, that was Shirley's performance. Now, Shirley, your mother seemed like she was definitely an interesting character. Could you say a little bit more about her?
Oh, I could probably keep us here for hours telling stories about her. I think that this particular incident was out of character for her because she was usually a very calm person. Mm-hmm. But the main thing about her that I would share is that she was a great storyteller herself. She was good at making up stories for children. She was good in passing on stories of her life as a younger person. So perhaps I was on stage because of her storytelling to me when I was a child.
So throughout the entire exchange of the story that you told, what was racing through you and your brother's mind? So I know you just mentioned that you think that this was out of character for your mother. So did you really think at that moment it was in your mother's capacity to injure or possibly murder your neighbor?
Well, actually, it happened so quickly that at the time, I'm not sure I was thinking anything. But in retrospect, since my father had just died and my mother was extremely emotional and on edge about a new future that she had to carve for herself, I truly believe if she felt that either she or her children were threatened, she would have gone ahead and hit the man with her weapon.
Okay, thank you so much for talking with us, Shirley, and thank you for giving us some more insight and details on your story. We're going to see you in the fall at the Academy of Music.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks for listening to the Valley Voices podcast, and thanks again to our friends at the Alva Stone and Montague for hosting the Neighbor Slam, and to our producing partners at the Academy of Music. In the next episode, we'll share stories from Andrew Shelfo, Katie Drum, and Teal Van Dyke on the theme The Silver Lining. To subscribe to the Valley Voices podcast and catch up on previous episodes, visit npr.net/valleyvoices or find us on Apple Podcasts. Be sure to leave us a review so other story lovers can find it too. Want to share your own story on the Valley Voices stage? Find out how to audition at npr.net/valleyvoices. I'm Summer Keppel. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.